How are you guys?
Good,
good.
We brought the bling.
Love the bling.
I know that Matt was calling us out on not even mentioning the Save Our Wallets. So this time, Matt, just for you, we got the bling sitting out there.
I think it worked too, because a lot of the language from the BRCA bill made its way into the market structure bill, which is the bigger bill that the cryptocurrency industry is pushing forward.
That's awesome.
And more likely to pass.
What is, I didn't actually know about the differences or what this. Can you represent a little bit of that? Because I don't.
Well, the market structure bill, they might have renamed it or added the name Clarity Act, but it largely represented the interests of like non-Bitcoin cryptocurrency, like more SEC related things. And then separately was the BRCA bill, which is what we've talked about a couple times in the show, which is unlikely to ever pass on its own because it's like very narrowly scoped.
Is that other thing something to do with Genius? Was that the stablecoin thing?
That's the stablecoin act.
That's different. That's an entirely different thing.
So strategically, it always needed to be attached to something else, and it got attached. A lot of the language got attached. It's pretty good. Not a perfect outcome, but a pretty darn good outcome.
The irony of needing to attach to various quirks and then calling it Clarity, of course, that's in par for the course. But.
Yeah.
When are we going to get LLMs to like run government?
Good Lord.
I want like a transparent LLM that's just like, we know how it operates. We know who trained it, what it's trained on. We can sort of analyze it and predict and get reliable outcomes for its decision making. To me, that's like, you know, that's when I begin voting.
That's the dream, babe. I'm not sure if, sadly, that's on the horizon, but that's the dream.
Steve is like, no comment.
It is what it is. Yeah.
So I think we had, whenever we hang out, we have so many things we want to talk about, but then we try to like come up with these topics for the show because we're like, actually, we should add a little clarity to it. So do you guys want to start with what we actually want to talk about, or you want to talk about the topics that we have listed?
I actually want to talk about what we have listed, so I'll go ahead and start us off, because I think as we were discussing today, a lot of times in the show, we start with more topical things happening in the news, and of course, there's, you know, no shortage of things in the news, but a lot of things in the news are also meant to distract and, you know, create awe, so I think it's often fun to take a step back if we don't have something that's super pressing and talk about a sort of bigger picture philosophical question or trend. So one thing that we've hinted at many times in the show, we've had in our own lunch conversations, our own chats many times, is, you know, what does the world look like on a Bitcoin standard? And what I mean by this is, I mean, we can take this in any number of directions, but, you know, it's an interesting time in the world to me because we're going through many simultaneous singularities. And on the one hand, we have AI, which is driving the cost of media and software creation to zero. We have my own personal sort of hot button topic, the cost of solar and storage, bringing the cost of energy radically cheaper at once. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time, we have this other singularity, which we all are obviously believers in or think is happening, which is transferring the capital of the world onto the Bitcoin network. And so each of these singularities are powerful in and of themselves. They all have sort of feedback loops in and on each other. I think it's also interesting to me because very few people in each of these camps really understand all of the implications of the singularities happening. Like someone deep in AI world probably has very little appreciation of like what the hell is going on with Bitcoin. Similarly, very many people in Bitcoin have very little appreciation of what's happening with information going to zero. So I think one thing I'd like to start with is just, you know, given all of that as context, as you look out 10, 20, 50 years in the future, you know, if that at least that one singularity of the Bitcoin capital network comes to fruition, potentially the others as well, how does the world change? How do the economics change? What are your initial thoughts?
I mean,
question.
It's so open-ended. You know, one of the things that I always think about is how money is a networked tool, but I think a lot of people like to reason about it from their own personal experience.
Yeah.
And so if you want to think about what does that future look like, I think you have to be imagining what does the networked version of money look like and not what does my individual experience work with. I think we had a conversation with somebody at a lunch table, I don't know, maybe a month or so ago. And it was mentioned like, oh, like all these people, you know, using debt and leverage and speculating and buying real estate and stuff, like that's the crazy stuff that's going to go away. And instead, the people like the carpenter who's doing the woodworking can just do their work and charge a fair wage. And I think in a sense that misses the fact that that carpenter is employed by somebody who's taking on leverage and debt to improve their real estate. And so it's you can't actually take individual, individual actors out of the system, and they can act kind of properly, and then everybody else can kind of correct and fix their behaviors. Like, everything changes, right? All of the relationships between people and what is charged. And we talked before about like real estate having like some store value component and some cash flow or utility component, and how do you disentangle this? But I think it's actually, everything's tangled up. So the first thing is, whenever we think about how does that future look, I think we have to think about how does that networked future look, and where are the kind of initial nodes of the network that cause it to evolve and cause new things to aggregate in new ways?
Yeah. I mean, one very sort of like simplistic take on this is, you know, all of us are, you know, well, I guess the sort of whole tagline for the show is the bridge to Silicon Valley. All of us have experience investing in startups and have seen, you know, successes here in Silicon Valley. And I think one of the beauties that has made Silicon Valley work over the decades is, basically shared upside. In the past, the skill set of engineers and software engineers in the last revolution was such that they were able to demand, I think, a seat at the table that was not just a wage, but actual equity and shared upside in the project. And I think that obviously in the current sort of like fiat bonanza world, Silicon Valley has gotten pretty warped, I would argue as well. But that fundamental principle of equity versus debt, I think, is a very important one. When you're working for a wage, and particularly a wage that is, you know, sort of being printed as monopoly money and is decreasing in purchasing power every year, you know, that is a very different relationship than when you're sharing in the upside and the downside of a project. And so I think one thing I've been thinking a lot more lately is, and actually we had one of our listeners and good friends of the show, Mark, gave us a little feedback last week that, you know, at terminal or steady state, perhaps the way to think about Bitcoin increasing in value is not in relationship to GDP growth, which is a measure of flows,
right,
but yep, in capital stock growth, like, yep, which is a measure of stock. So in thinking about, if you take all of the world's capital assets and you denominate that in Bitcoin, however much those capital assets increase over time, that's going to be the sort of rate of growth of Bitcoin. Let's just say, for the sake of sakes, that's 4%. Maybe it's 2%, maybe it's 10%, whatever. It's some percentage. And that will change over time as well based on technology. But if we say it's 4%, in that new Bitcoin standard world, the new hurdle rate is 4%. So if I'm the carpenter or whatever I am, and I'm doing an honest job and I'm stacking, you know, my Bitcoin, then...
I like how you said that.
I know my audience. I'm stacking my Bitcoin.
Get punched from the side.
Exactly. I've caved to peer pressure here. Then I know that whatever I use that money for, I need to credibly believe I'm going to clear 4% return, because just saving, just the instrument and the capital instrument in which I'm saving is 4%. And so I think in that world, you're going to have a lot less debt, and the debt that does exist, it needs to have a really, really compelling use case that's going to pay back higher. And so I think you're going to see a lot more equity, which is shared upside in a project that you believe could do better.
Actually, I have a question about that.
Please.
So let's say it's 4%.
Yeah.
You said that the investment I make has to clear that hurdle.
Mm-hmm.
But does it, like, let's say you have a startup and I'm your investor. Well, okay. It depends on the, I guess for equity investment, yeah. For debt, no.
Exactly.
Because debt, if it all works out well, I get my capital, my mm-hmm. principal back, and I only need like something greater than 0% mm-hmm. return. I guess you're saying with equity. Okay.
Yeah. And yeah. So I think what ends up shifting over time is you're going to see, the quality of projects that get undertaken or experiments that get run is going to be naturally higher, because there's going to be less just like crazy money out there. But I think you're also going to see a lot more in general, just like everything turns equity or as much as possible, because in that world, you're sharing both upside and downside. Whereas in the current world, in the debt world, someone is trading that upside for perceived clarity or perceived certainty in what they're going to get. But obviously that perceived certainty is kind of like hand waved away because it's monopoly money. So yeah, I think we're just going to see a lot more equity. And to your point, if I'm investing in your company, and then this is what I think about all the time, and even for my fund, right? Because I have LPs ask me all the time, like, are you going to beat the Bitcoin hurdle rate? And the short answer is, I don't know. I mean, beating the Bitcoin hurdle rate, if we think it's going to grow many orders of magnitude for an entire fund, It's a very tricky enterprise. I actually don't think hardly any asset class or any venture capital fund is going to beat that over time. There will be exceptions, but to have that exception, and this is kind of what I explained to people. One, everyone's already kind of on board with the thesis, so they're already, you know, sort of down for the cause, which is good. It increases the holding of stacks. There's a lot of reasons to do it. But is that we still have that outlier potential of, okay, if everything converts to a Bitcoin standard, there will be new Googles and there will be new really, really large companies built. And if we hit one of those, then we can outperform. But it's a much higher bar. You have to really believe this thing could get very successful.
But so I don't think you've said it directly, but yeah. A concern that I've heard and maybe we've talked about before is with a loose money policy, there's just lots of funding in Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
And, you know, one can argue that's kind of wasteful, but it also gives a lot of talent to people room to come up with the next Google.
Yeah.
And so if we have a money that in a system that doesn't really result in that, is that going to slow down innovation? I'm not too worried about that though, because in parallel with this, if we just look at over time, back in like the 80s and 90s, the venture capital world was like, took 6 to 18 months to just vet a startup
right.
to even make an investment. And then the investment was usually quite large because mm-hmm. the team needed a lot of money to actually build whatever they were building,
right?
Be it hardware or software. And obviously as time's gone on now you can build applications extremely quickly. Mm-hmm. Now we're in a world where anyone can build an application extremely easily and quickly at no cost.
Yep.
So an individual person can cycle through hundreds of ideas in a short period of time.
Yeah.
And find, so I think we're going to see product market fit discovered much more quickly. You don't need investment. And as an entrepreneur, you would not want investment because why would you give up equity in your in your startup? When you don't really need to, then once you have product market fit, well, then you might need capital to, you know, to do marketing or hire people or what have you. But at that point, you're in a stronger position. And as an investor, you have more confidence in clearing that hurdle rate at that maturity level from the startup. So I think these two will like can coincide with each other and it won't stunt innovation.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a bunch of headwinds and tailwinds to all of this. And I'm a fan of kind of the Bitcoin standard future that I think we're contemplating, but I also don't know that I would see equity ownership versus debt ownership as like equity good, debt bad. I think there's just different tools that have different risk profiles and different trade-offs. Right. And like, we'd like to get out of the fiat systems that have a lot of corruption and how the money gets printed, how it gets allocated, who's close to the money printer and stuff. So I think like I'm on board with the idea of let's reinvent. But I don't know that equity versus debt is necessarily like such a strong distinction to make, and sort of certainly to not imply a value judgment on one of them in the current situation. Like if you want to build something today, you kind of have to build a little bit in the current situation, a little bit towards the future. I think about some of the kinds of, you know, like you mentioned, how cheap it is to build something. I was actually, my neighbor was just showing me. Do you know what WebVan is? I'm going to ask the little kid
of
first.
Of course. Okay. Yeah.
So WebVan is basically Instacart, right? But it was done.
But 10 years too early.
Yeah, maybe 15
years too early.
Maybe even 20. Yeah. But definitely way too early. But like the idea worked.
Yeah.
And the idea is worth a ton. And we use it, you know, several times a week now. There was the early Instacart thing has some of the footage filmed here in the Presidio, which is kind of how the conversation came about.
Yeah.
But I thought it was interesting that that's, you know, it's 15, 20 year delay. And I think probably the original, you know, WebVan was, I don't know, probably $50 million, which was big in back in the day. And Instacart was probably basically built for kind of nothing, you know, web app or a mobile app, get it going. And then it used capital to scale.
Right.
And so, you know, I think that trend line is not stopped. That is continuing. So like, yeah, being able to use LLMs as a tool to help build the next software product, I think you're going to get tons of traction before you need it. So you might be able to actually skip, you know, at some future point, you might be able to skip equity investment and use something more of a debt-like instrument because you're trading it off against future cash flows that you're already generating. Mm-hmm. All that is not to say that, debt is good or equity is bad or anything. It's just, these are just different tools, I think.
So what you're saying, Marc Andreessen said the last job standing was venture capital. What you're saying is it's the first to go.
Well, I think in certain cases, like if your main job is to allocate to like two people in a garage, that probably doesn't work at massive scale as well 10 years from now as it has 10 years ago.
So all of us as early stage investors, we need to find a new
it's been real, guys.
Well, just, you know,
no, I agree. I totally agree with you.
Help people who are excited about something. I do this all the time where something I'm not invested in formally, but I just like the person. I like the problem. I want to help them get to where they're going. I don't need to own equity in the thing. And then, yeah, if it takes off, I'm sure I'll get a chance to buy a piece of it if they're selling pieces of it to people. But I don't think it has to be like the structure that we have had around how, oh, it's this, you know, factory farm startups that go through seed and get ARR and then they do blah, 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 blah. I don't think that has to be the case anymore. And especially as this trend continues, you extrapolate what it is like, probably SpaceX, you couldn't imagine getting traction unless you have hundreds of millions of dollars invested. But maybe 10 or 20 years from now, that's not the case. Maybe you could actually dream up and build a SpaceX-like company, you know, vibe manufactured.
Vibe the rocket.
By the way, it seems like Founders You Should Know is well-positioned for this, right? Because it's sort of the entry point is when someone has product market fit.
Yep. That's a good point.
It most certainly is.
We've not talked about it on the show.
We haven't. Yeah. So my wife started this community called Founders You Should Know, and the purpose is to help founders who are building a explosive growth startup be able to find and attract great engineers. And so great engineers are kind of on the other side of the marketplace. The marketplace is basically like a community of great engineers who want to hear about all the great new companies being built that are actually working. Because like most really talented engineers don't want to wander the idea maze, even with the two most talented friends they ever met who are starting a company. They're like, okay, cool, bro. Like, let me know when it works, right? Whereas if you're like, hey, I want to work on something. I'm really good. I want to make sure that the work I'm doing creates value in the world. Then you want to join something right as it's inflecting. There's no better time than right as that inflection is hitting. And you're like helping, you know, the work you're doing is going to be valued and used and it's going to be useful to the world. So you know that you're contributing to kind of creation of something that's going to be ongoing. So my wife organized this community and, you know, there's kind of all of the really talented engineers looking for the explosive startups on one side. And then there's the explosive startups on the other side. It's kind of like, feels like a demo day, but it's a very different audience. It's, you know, 12 startups pitching to a room of engineers. And then it's just like, get out of the way and let the match make. And so as part of that, and I'm involved as like the MC, but I'm supportive.
He's a good MC. There's usually some fun exercises required to go to the show.
But the point of all that is, yeah, like it may be that the seed stage, more of that can be sort of more of the traction can be proven ahead of time. And we actually see this. We've seen companies that get to like 8 figures in revenue with like
Jesus,
handful of people, maybe founders plus a few contractors, or you know, the amount that you
didn't
can accomplish.
Cursor go through Founders You Should Know.
They did.
Cursor went through Founders. Yeah, and Any Sphere, I think it was called.
There.
That was pretty wild.
It seems like Founders You Should Know might want to consider like promoting vibe coding even more, because it would result in like higher quality product market fit companies.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think vibe coding is one of these kind of concepts that is just going to change the world in so many different ways. And I've been public talking about it, and people are always like joking with me. Like we were on that group chat, and, you know, I won't call him out, but he was like, oh, why don't you just vibe code that? And I was like, actually, like that's what I was doing. And I got stuck and I'm trying to fix that problem.
Give it 6 months.
Yeah, right. So I think encouraging more vibe coding, yes. Have a channel in the Founders You Should Know Slack where we talk. We have a vibe coding channel actually now, where we have a bunch of people gathered and chatting. Yeah,
okay, good.
Trading ideas on how to do it. But I think it's, you know, that idea is so big that it's like everybody should be doing it. Everybody should be playing with these tools. Everybody should be understanding the trade-offs and techniques and how to use it. Because I think we've talked before, I kind of call myself a full-time vibe coder. I really spend like a lot of my time doing this. Like yesterday, I was in the gym, and in between sets, I was on Replit on my phone working on my Nostrobot, literally.
A literal and figurative flex.
I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding. It's so fun. And you can actually, I've kind of gone through the cycle. Like we played with Replid 2 years ago.
Yep.
Was it? And it was just like, you couldn't really do anything. And you kind of, I think we spent a whole hour or two and didn't really get anywhere with it. Then 4 to 6 months ago, I started working on this thing. I made like a lot of progress, but it would get stuck in these weird ways and whatever. But it was beautiful. You just deploy it right away. So it was like really simplified a lot. And then I went on the journey of like, okay, I'm a real engineer. I'm going to go, you know, use like Cursor and Windsurf and Klein and
make it hard.
You know, all of the, because they're much more flexible. You can change the models. You can understand what it's doing and point out problems. And then this week, I went back and did a couple of projects on Replit again. And I'm like, my mind is blown. I'm like, okay, Replit now doesn't get stuck in that same way. If it does get stuck, I can unstick it. I can probe around and explain what I want it to do. And I've just, I think, built my own comfortability with what kinds of workflows I need to do to make it, to get the best out of it. And so so I think I've become a bit of a Replit maxi, as Matt coined the term.
Another thing I know you're playing with, and by the way, apologies for completely getting off the Bitcoin standard.
That's okay.
We'll come back to
it. Yeah.
But related to the topic of like reducing costs to create a startup, not only coding, but like marketing,
yeah.
Right? And so a tool that some of us have been playing with is Google's new VO3 mm-hmm. model.
Oh, yeah.
For video creation and scene creation, audio and video. And I mean, at least Matt and yourself have had your mind blown. I need to play with it a little bit more to blow my mind, but I've seen what you guys have.
You had your mind
created.
Implode or something.
I saw your commercial in Vegas. It was like, damn.
So, actually, where I did see a great result is a video for the Stratum V2 protocol that Pavlenix created, and he used the VO3 model. He did also do post production manually,
right,
to really get it there. But it's a well done video, and it was a one man show.
Yep.
which is pretty cool. So you can imagine if you're a founder, you can like go ideate, you can build like dozens of applications to figure out what's the right application. And then you can like be the one person show to create a really compelling marketing video and just an overall marketing plan too.
I almost might think if you're thinking about building something, I almost might reverse those and say, make the marketing video and figure out what story you want to tell, how you want to inspire people about why this tool or project is useful and important, and then maybe make like the marketing copy on the website and collect a bunch of emails to sign up or whatever you want to do, or, you know, start a Nostra account or whatever and start collecting NPubs, or, you know, have people follow you. But I think sort of work from kind of that customer experience, which is like, I'm inspired by the VO video and then, oh, I'm going to sign up and follow on the website. And then, oh, okay, now that people seem to be into this and they're talking, they're giving feedback, they're asking, does it do this, does it do that? Then you go build the thing more focused on the spec of what you're learning people actually value out of it.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask an off-the-wall question, which maybe you guys aren't ready for, but like, is there a way to incorporate Bitcoin or Bitcoin payments into this in terms of testing out ideas? If I create three different marketing video, or like maybe one concept, three ways to tell the story,
mm-hmm.
or three different concepts or whatever, and then I want to like put it out to the world, is there a way like to use Bitcoin either to pay people to pay attention, or they pay for some reason, or, you know, almost like voting, or any ideas?
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me a bit of like there was a whole CPA space, you know, cost per acquisition, kind of cost per lead space.
I'm sure you're gonna do some accounting for that.
It's like a way to price an ad unit is cost per acquisition. And it was kind of this alternative payments mechanism, originally innovated by TrialPay, if I recall correctly, but it kind of got used by a lot of people. But one of the core things was sign up to like, you know, Netflix, if you've ever seen those, like sign up to Netflix, or watch a video, take a survey, and then whoever served that video gets paid whatever the survey firm would value. So you can imagine being the survey firm and paying Bitcoin to get people to watch the video and answer two or three quick questions about it, and maybe you give them something, you know, give them a little bit of Bitcoin in exchange for that. Or you could imagine like more sophisticated, systems around how that works. But I think you definitely could. The other thing is, because all of this generation, there's a cost to all of it. Sometimes when you use a service, like maybe you sign up for ChatGPT and you can start using it for free or something, and they're subsidizing the cost. But you could imagine services like, I think somebody shared PPQ.ai, which I'm like,
it's a
somewhat familiar
person in the Bitcoin space created it.
Yeah.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah.
Because I looked at the payment and they seem to have like, if you pay with Lightning, it's a 5% discount.
Cheaper, yeah.
You can pay with on-chain Bitcoin and there's no discount. And then you can pay with like basically every stable coin and maybe Monero and some other stuff too. but it's basically taking, I think, an API version of almost every chat, image, or video generation, including VO3.
Like OpenRouter, kind of.
Yeah. And you can just pay like, oh, here's, you know, $5 worth of Bitcoin and generate this video for me.
Yeah, I think this is a really good point. It brings up actually a couple of thoughts. I mean, one thought I have is, so, you know, as everything is becoming super abundant, information is super abundant, energy is super abundant, they're not free critically. I think you start thinking, we've always talked about, you know, if we put on our investor hats, you still invest where the scarcity is, if there's scarcity. And if there's no scarcity left in the world, well, then our investor mindsets no longer matter. But I don't believe that. So what I think is interesting there is what's still going to be scarce in that world. We've talked, obviously, Bitcoin. So money, one half of every trade, which goes back to why people will be less likely to part with their Bitcoin in the first place because they have a higher hurdle rate. Potentially positions within the Lightning Network, which we talked about a lot last week, having specific areas where you can add value by routing payments. That's potentially scarce. Then the hardware themselves. So the actual compute and the energy, which is going asymptotic with zero, but not actually zero. And so in that world, if you think about investing in other kinds of things, whether it's games or apps or movies or whatever the next generation is, the other thing that's always scarce is attention. And attention is very important. There's going to be attention of humans and attention of agents, by the way. So I always find it interesting that the most revolutionary breakthroughs are always pretty simple. Attention is, in fact, all you need. Mm-hmm. And so in that world, what I think is going to be interesting is when you ask yourself, okay, if I'm investing in a company that's trying to do something which effectively is, you know, fueled by human attention, let's say. I also think that the turnover rate, like I even see this myself, and I don't think this is necessarily a good thing, which is why as the world's gotten crazier, I've actually just pulled off of Twitter the last 2 days because it's fucking crazy. But the like sort of turnover is getting faster and faster. Like, okay, the new attention thing grabs you. Okay, the new attention. And so I wonder in that world, you know, I almost see, and again, maybe there's room for financing. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's all people that have, you know, built up enough Bitcoin, they can run their own experiments. But in that world, I see it more almost like the way, I guess, like movies work. Movies or like other creative productions like music. Essentially, you're creating a product. People are less, and I saw a tweet about this last week that really resonated with me, which is you're less, if you're doing a startup, it's less about I'm the core operator that can do all the operational things. And it's more like, no, I'm the person with great taste that can just knows what an awesome album sounds like, or what an awesome movie looks like, or what an awesome video game looks like. And essentially, you're basically financing people with great taste that know how to use the tools, and maybe they need some help using the tools, but they can produce stuff that people love. And so in that case, you're not betting on it like, okay, I'm trying to invest in a company like Facebook that's going to just be the dominant thing. And once it's got monopoly position, you're never fucking getting out ever, unless Nostra breaks it. But in that world, instead, it's kind of like movies. Like, okay, a movie goes to the box office, it runs for whatever a month. You get your ideally big return on it if it's a really good movie, and then you move on to the next one. And people, and I think that kind of like—
You're saying you're hypothesizing, would startups go in that direction?
Yeah, I think they will. And I'm saying like in general, you know, and even the kinds of things one might invest in as a startup, it actually might be, to your point, it might not be a startup. It might be the kinds of things that are more valuable are things like movies, games, like stuff that people actually want to interact with. And I guess what I'm saying is operations becomes less important than taste in that world. Mm-hmm. If the AIs are doing a lot of the operations.
We are all becoming Rick Rubens.
something like that. But I think what's interesting there is, you know, your time horizon is also, interestingly, this goes against, you know, a lot of the Bitcoin stuff, but it's much shorter. Because you say like, look, we're only going to capture attention for a week long span or a month long span, like a movie. But I also think it maybe reflects the sort of rhythms of human life much more naturally, which is like, to me, the worst part of like a job, you know, for the brief periods I ever had anything resembling one, was just the horror of just the grind over and over. And like something that's beautiful and fun for a year can become horrible by year three. And I think any entrepreneur knows exactly what I'm talking about. And so, But if you look at something like a film or a movie, it's like you work your ass off and you produce it and it gets done for a certain amount of time, then you're done. Then you have a break and then you do the next one. And I think that, you know, that kind of world where people get together for projects, collaborate, maybe there's financing, maybe there's not, you break up, then you do another one, you break up, then you do another one, I think is a lot more natural and healthy is my guess.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I guess that's part of what, as costs to create things go to zero, like I think people are freed up to do more creative work and creation work. And some of it, like a lot of it will not be super interesting to many people, but maybe they're interesting to the people who created it. Or maybe they end up every, you know, one in every 100 or 1,000 things that get created end up having a moment and being around and interesting and broadly visible for maybe a week or two or a month or two.
Yeah.
But I don't know that in that world, you know, I don't know that in that world you want to actually try to own equity in that thing.
Yeah,
I think you kind of want to just say, peace, it was nice, it had its moment, you know.
Well, you may want to own some of the cash flows. Like, for example, just like, let's say, I don't know what the new expensive thing is. I think one thing we always forget is like, oh, like if we can cover all the costs of like a movie production in today's world, that's all we ever need. It's like, no, the more technology we get, the more we want to do crazy new things. Yeah. So it's hard to imagine we're like, oh, energy is going to get free. It's like, well, it's never going to get free. And from our current relative position, it seems free. But from the position of a human 10,000 years in the future, it's going to be like, oh, these puny humans, they are using less than 1% of the world of the sun's energy. Like, what cavemen? Mm-hmm. And so there will always be a lot of new things we can do. And so I think there's never going to be a shortage of like financing, whatever that new scarce thing is at the frontier. But to be clear, I mean, people do make great money on like movies, right? So like, if you say, listen, I know that like, you know, there's going to be a fat tail, which is we're going to get, you know, massive revenues back in the first whatever month after producing this. And then there's this infinite long tail, which is like, okay, you know, it loses its attention because it becomes a cult classic. And then maybe one day it resurfaces. But in that world,
a lot of that is IP that is not, that's going through a traditional set of gatekeepers.
Yes.
And if you reshape all those gatekeepers, which is obviously happening,
yes,
then the IP itself may not extract as much value.
So here's the interesting thing. So I've thought a lot about this one. And in my episode with Dhruv on Ideas from the Edge, we go deep on this. But I think what's going to happen is, so I'm very anti-IP. I think it's ridiculous. I think it's fake. I think it defies the natural laws of gravity. Or whatever you want to call that, the natural laws. And so what I think you would invest into that world as an example is, I always give the example of Radiohead. They released the album In Rainbows, mm-hmm. which I think was in 2011 or no, 2007 or 2008. And they released that album and it was pay what you want. So it was free. And so they released it as a torrent file and anyone could torrent it, right? Yep. But interestingly, a lot of people did pay. Now that's sort of the value for value model. And it's like, well, if you have a big enough audience and 1% or 2%, 3% pay like Radiohead, you can still do, you know, I think they did nearly as well as they would have with a traditional release because they had a big audience. So I think what can happen in that world is you just kind of, you shift from IP, which is like monetization at the face of a gun, like through force, which I think is that's never a good model. Instead, what you can do is you can explore new models, which might be, okay, the file for this movie or the file for this song or whatever is infinite. Anyone can copy it because that's the way information works. However, there is a specific file, a specific torrent file or whatever the file, you know, media type is, which is signed probably with their Nostr private key. And we know that this is the file that came from Radiohead's account or whatever you want to call it. Similarly, any money that goes through there, whether that's a tip or a donation value for value style, whether that is some kind of unlock, like maybe to your question, Steve, like what might people be using Bitcoin for? What are they using games today? It's like, oh, I have this game, but I want to unlock my custom character skin and I'll pay whatever, you know, 1,000 Bitcoin for that or whatever it is. You can then see potentially using something like Nostr, waterfall splits built into that. And so what I mean by that is, and you can even build sort of a marketing into that where anyone could share any version of that file. But if I share the one that becomes the shelling point, which is most likely to be the one that Radiohead signed, and any money that flows through there, I'm able to get a cut of that depending where I am in the waterfall, then I'm going to keep sharing that file. And so if I'm, you know, earlier on, like equity, it's like a reimagination of equity. It's like what you're purchasing is a position in a waterfall of cash flows. But like hard-coded position. And if that file loses relevance, well, then you lose that cash flow.
What prevents like just bots, me creating thousands of bots that share everything?
What do you mean share everything?
Just try to put yourself into that flow.
To capture as much.
Any new thing that gets published, somebody creates a bot and tries to use totally. An audience of that bot to
This is where I think that the private key or public private key identity systems like in Nostr are going to be so important, because clearly that's going to happen. And I would argue that increasingly, when I was again a few days ago on X and I saw some like bizarre tweet from like Department of Homeland Security or something of like some dude, like one of these dudes standing on a truck, I was like, this is clearly meant to like manipulate the fuck out of me. Like I need to turn this off immediately. So I think that the old internet's basically already dead and drowning. And so in that world, the thing that the bots can never replicate is the signature from Radiohead. And so I think that, I don't know exactly how it's going to manifest, but the authenticity of signing with a private key is the key. And so my guess is somehow the new interfaces are going to be like AI to AI. So it's not even going to be like, oh, I'm sitting there scrolling through a screen. It's going to be like, okay, I'm talking with my AI friend or assistant, and it knows to fetch the correct one from the waterfall, or not correct, but it fetches the one that's most popular, has the biggest cash flows. And I think that the authenticity from Radiohead's signature is what's going to allow for that.
So this touches on another topic that I think we've either discussed after the show, I think, but not on air.
Something spicy.
Proof of personhood. So This is a topic that I think this is sort of the headline of why WorldCoin claims that their service is valuable. And then I think...
We discussed this live on the show.
Did we discuss it live? Okay, sorry. I sometimes don't separate reality from fiction.
This is what happens when you spend too much time vibe coding, guys. Careful.
But does it matter? Does proof of personhood matter for that? Because now I saw somebody shared something like A16Z had their like crypto hypotheses of what should be on proof of personhood is one of the...
Is that still going?
Well, we've been not skeptical, but curious to hear compelling arguments for proof of personhood. And I still haven't heard any that are super compelling, other than like dating apps or whatever, which is a bit niche. I don't think like a new money is needed to be created, like WorldCoin, just for dating apps. And on social media, I'm still not convinced that I really care that I know it's a human. Meaning, I might follow a set of people I actually know are human and I know them. I either know of their reputation or I know them as friends or colleagues or whatever. But in all those situations, a Nostr signature is completely adequate. Just like I trust Signal that I'm talking to David King or Max Webster, I may have even done the safety verification dance, like we actually exchanged this information in person, that I'm really confident same thing can be done with Nostr.
Yeah. And I think, Steve, maybe you said this last week or whenever we discussed it, but I think the key is not proof of personhood. It's proof of authenticity. Like, I don't care necessarily. Like, there I'm sure will be cases, like you mentioned a few, where the proof of specific personhood matters. But in my mind, what matters is, am I getting value from this? And is it the source of value that I think it is? So in the case of like, one example, sorry, that it's coming to me now, proof of person. And what I assume that WorldCoin is going to try and do is, if you wanted to do some kind of like UBI, which I'm not saying that's a good idea, but some kind of like, okay, I want to make sure, let's make this a more market friendly version. I want to make sure I'm paying out the revenue streams to the right person, while, you know, whether it's a bot or a human, I don't really care about, but I do care that the money is flowing to the right account that actually subscribed to me or whatever it was.
Since we're talking about WorldCoin right now, I know that one, we did cover it on another show and we got some audience feedback about just pointing out that I think one of their value propositions is like fairness in distribution. That fairness stemming from, well, you scan your eyeball, you get some tokens, and every human gets the same number of tokens for their eyeball scan. So if you just, you know, look at it from just that lens, okay, that sounds equal distribution to everyone. But I know, David, you brought up you questioned that, and at least one specific example is like, well, what about the people born after this initial distribution? Yeah. why, how is that fair to them? So I think in general, there is no like there's no system that can be created that is everyone would agree is perfectly fair.
Right.
Like with Bitcoin, we also talk about like its distribution mechanism. And a lot of people in Bitcoin claim it's fair. I do think it's relatively fair. Do I think it's perfectly fair? No, because like people who were on the Cypherpunk mailing list who discovered this first had an advantage over the rest of the world, let alone people who weren't born yet. So it's I don't even know. I don't even know what perfectly fair means.
Anybody could have been on the Cypherpunk. Yeah. Email list, right? I think fairness.
Well, not the kids who are not yet born.
Exactly. Yeah, those are really under.
Like with Bitcoin, I think you can point to many attributes it has that absolutely make it more fair than its counterparts, whether it be other cryptocurrencies or, the dollar or fiat currencies.
Yeah,
and that's why people would claim it's more fair.
But I think fairness is such a tough thing to make any claims about because like. The world is not fair. Physics is not fair. The way energy works throughout the universe, it's just not fair. It just is what it is. And so when we try to layer on human systems to create fairness, we need somebody to adjudicate this and to balance all of these things. And just any given person is just not going to be able to do that for everybody. So I think, I think I mentioned in chat, have you guys ever read Chris Voss, Never Split the Difference?
No.
You never heard of it?
I've heard the name of it,
but in the chat.
Oh, just in the chat. Yeah. Oh, okay. It was kind of a big book, I don't know, 10 or 12 years ago, maybe 15 years ago. But it was I think he's an FBI negotiator. And he basically told how they did hostage negotiations and what kinds of techniques they used and where he saw people go wrong when trying to do these hostage negotiations. One of the positions he takes is never talk to your counterparty about fairness because you can't defend your position on it and they can't defend theirs. And it's just, everybody's going to have their own interpretation of fairness. So when you start with a marketing claim that, hey, this is more fair, I become very, very skeptical. I'm like, when you say fair, I hear you're trying to manipulate me. I don't hear fair because I don't think fair exists. I think it just unfortunately doesn't. So I think what you want is to try to be as neutral as possible and kind of equal access as possible. And we can't do that for people who are going to be born in the future. But we can say anybody was allowed to be on the Cypherpunk email list. It wasn't just the blessed few who gatekept each other into it or out, or it had a $10,000 a month subscription to get into the Cypherpunk email list. It's like, if you cared about it, you get in. And there's advantages to caring about being on the Cypherpunk email list that I was not aware that advantage would exist. I wasn't on the email list at the time. I wish I was, but...
A likely story. Just what Satoshi would want us to think.
I think the whole concept is kind of the whole concept of fairness is a flawed one. So I think you have to look at like how neutral is the distribution. And that's the only thing you can really go off of. And I think when you have something like WorldCoin says, hey, we're going to mediate fairness, every human should get an equal amount. But then I'm like, okay, well, why should the team get, what do they have, 30%? Pre-mine or whatever it is, why should the team get 30% if we're all equal humans? Yeah. Are we really as equal? Is it really that fair? And I think I could hear them saying, okay, totally makes sense because we're the team who made it. So we put in all this extra work. Well, what about the person who was solving cancer? Like, what about the cancer surgeon? What, like they did their work on other stuff. Why do they not get an advantage for doing that relative to the person who drove the Uber to get to the thing? Like, we just value things differently and we have to accept that that's just the case.
Yeah. So it's very interesting you bring this up. So I tend to agree with you and what you're essentially describing as a form of Taoism, which I tend to agree with, which is that like we can like use our minds all we want to say this ought to be that way and it should be this way, but like nature's going to nature. And like the more, as Buckminster Fuller, my hero, says, we go with forces and use them instead of fighting them, the better off we all are. So I tend to agree with you and all that. And I also tend to agree to your point, Steve, like there's no such thing as like, you know, perfectly fair. There's a spectrum, perhaps. And I think we can, you know, aim for certainly the most open and neutral system possible, which is, to the best of my knowledge, of everything I've seen, Bitcoin seems to qualify that. However, it's interesting that you guys bring this up today, because in just the last 2 days, I've had a couple of conversations. One of my LPs dropped by Pursuit of Bitcoin on Tuesday. He brought this up. and then another guy in the sauna last night. And shout out, we have a new guy working with us on the Presidio Bitcoin Jam that I met in the sauna. So the sauna has been a really fertile place for for orange pilling and whatnot. Oh, yeah, actually, I don't know about all that. It's a men's only sauna there, so definitely not too fertile.
We're gonna let you dig this hole.
Yeah,
keep digging.
All we want to. However, the question that this guy asked me last night, and he's a very reasonable guy, and I would say, you know, definitely more of like a left of center, but like open-minded. And you know, ultimately we discussed this for over an hour, and it ultimately came down to him and even my LP saying like he thinks the biggest risk still with Bitcoin is that, you know, there's still too much concentration in the hands of early whales, which, you know, I mean, my argument there would be it is what it is. As the market price goes up, they'll sell more, or their kids will eventually lose it if they're not responsible. And like, that's just how nature works. But it's, you know, it is a valid concern that as more people realize like, oh shit, like, you know, is there like a new sort of ruling class that will never, you know, lose their wealth? I think that's one criticism. And then the guy last night, his point to me was, he was like, yeah, essentially it just boiled down to, you know, if this thing goes up forever and I heard about it too late, like, I just am not interested, which eventually nature will kind of force you in if you're interested or not.
That's the ego test though, right?
Yeah. Well,
everybody has to
respond to both of those. Yeah.
Oh, that, I feel like the answer to the last one is easy, yeah. I think, for a couple of reasons. We've already seen, you know, what, 15 years of history of price appreciation. So obviously everyone wishes they were the first, like, bought, you know, I would have loved to sold the pizzas for 10,000 Bitcoin, BTC, and then, you know, and then held on because, right, like, you know, and now
Bitcoin was worth a lot.
And now Bitcoin's worth 100 million times more, right? Yeah. So, you know, then people who entered a few years later, they felt like they were late. And then people who entered in 2017 felt they were too late, and 2020 felt they were too late. And well, any of these entry points, you've done pretty well.
People who enter in 2030 will feel like they're too late.
Yeah. And they will likely do well. Are they going to get 100 million X return? No. But are they going to preserve their savings and have it, the purchasing power of it, increase by 4 to 8% or whatever?
Yeah.
Yeah. So so it'll become less of like a speculative venture capital investment and just more like a obvious value proposition to a person. So
savings technology.
You're going to move beyond, especially like the newly born generation, they're not going to have this, like, you know, hate built in them that they didn't invest early enough. It's just more like, this is a tool. This is a monetary tool that exists for me, and it's the obvious choice. That's one answer. And then the second answer is we're going to see a shift to like Bitcoin is everyday currency, money, and like using applications. And in that mindset, you're not thinking of it as like a speculative investment and wanting to like get rich.
Yeah.
You're actually like,
it's a tool.
Paying the AI or like whatever it is, it's a tool. It's a utility to you. So you're motivated to do it because it's the only way to achieve that utility in your life.
Yeah.
I think also I hear the phrase savings a lot, and I do think that Bitcoin is a great savings technology and tool. But I think in a sense that undersells it to people who haven't really digested what it is. It's actually still in the phase of being a speculative investment.
It's both.
it's a savings tool, but then they see it go up and down like, wait, it went down. I thought it was for saving. Okay, you're still in the speculative phase. That's why you have the chance at a 10x or 100x or maybe more from here over the next, you know, decades. But you have that because it's more than just a savings tool. It's also a speculation that everybody will agree that this is a savings tool at some point in the future.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
So don't undersell it by saying, oh, it's just for maintaining. It's built to do that. It's good at that at large scale, but today it's still a speculative investment. And
how would you guys answer the question that there's still the amount of concentration in early adopters is still going to be like, I don't know, it's going to create a lot of havoc or resentment. Like, is that just, it is what it is?
I think that's possible, but I think it's also possible for like people who control really powerful AIs.
Yeah.
They may end up accumulating a lot of the Bitcoin that's available because they control that AI. So like maybe the people who were the early adopters are not going to be the people who actually own a lot of it, but it's really the people who own and control the AIs who end up owning it. So I just think like the world is complex and it's a bit chaotic. And things will, innovation will continue to march on. People will create things that have never existed before, and they'll end up owning a lot of Bitcoin because they created something that's valuable to the world.
Yeah.
So
it gets back to your previous philosophical point of like, I mean, the world's kind of messy and dynamic, and you can't force some kind of equal distribution of things on the world.
Yeah, as much like, as people like, would like to.
Yeah, so like with cryptocurrency, there's been cryptocurrencies with this fair distribution, you know, quote, fair distribution, where they're going to give equal amounts to everyone, except, of course, themselves. They give a lot more to.
But they're special.
But it's the same with like AI models.
Yeah.
Like how are you going to distribute the power of AI models to everyone in the world? I mean, there's going to be attempts like, okay, let's open source the LLM models and things like that. That's great, but it's still not going to equally empower every person with that or distribute the value to every person based on that.
And I think you could see, you know, I think that the story of progress, I would guess, does continue to accumulate more capital assets within a fewer number. It doesn't mean it's not good for everybody. It's good for everybody. It brings everybody up, but it also probably concentrates wealth in ways that I don't know for sure if you sort of did a historical analysis exactly how kings and fiefdoms and stuff work. But like, you know, I think the march of progress in technology does actually concentrate a lot of power and asset wealth in the hands of the very few. So I think, you know, people opt in because it actually ultimately is good for everybody and people want the benefits. And so people opt into that system.
And to be clear, even if there are, you know, sort of, I don't know, new age kings or lords or whatever you want to call it, I still don't think we recreate the feudal system. I would argue we have the feudal system today because in the feudal system, you don't own the land upon which you work. And to me, that is like, what's his name? The Greek finance minister who like has a lot of good criticisms of the system, but is not yet orange pilled. Maybe he'll get there. Anyways, his whole argument is like that. That's what Facebook and Twitter and all these centrally owned platforms are. Is those are fiefdoms and people that work on their
like sharecroppers. Yeah.
Jinx. And so in this new world that we're moving towards, you know, there is a critical difference, which is you still have the ability to own your own land in cyberspace, things like Bitcoin, Nostr identity, and, you know, it's open. And so from there, you can kind of do pretty much anything that your imagination will allow for. And so I still think it's a radically different world than sort of the...
And also, because of how dynamic technology is,
yeah,
those winners in those systems change and new ones emerge again and again and again. So if you look back to a kingdom and fiefdom and stuff, those probably lasted for generations.
Right.
Today, you know, if you looked 20 years ago, it looked like, I don't know, like Google, Facebook was kind of it. That was like going to be...
Maybe
Google or
Microsoft.
Microsoft, right? Yeah.
Like 95 to 2000, it looked like Microsoft and Intel were just going to utterly dominate. It was
Intel.
There was a ton of
Intel
concern
looked really good
in the 90s, especially 90, like Windows 95. Wintel.
Yeah.
And it was hard to see how that was duopoly was going to be broken.
Yeah.
But I mean, to be fair, Microsoft is still the most valuable company in the world, and Intel completely fumbled the ball and gave it to NVIDIA.
But the point is, like, if they just continued doing Windows operating system for PCs, they would be nowhere.
Exactly.
It wouldn't exist.
Well, you saw it. I mean, for a decade, like from 2000 to 2010, Microsoft went
they were
nowhere.
Yeah.
It's a pretty incredible resurgence.
It
but
is.
Then to your point, Intel, you know, has largely just fallen off.
Yeah. I think one other thing that I want to go back and circle back on, which is informed by this, is, you know, again, thinking about as we're talking live, the structure of equity versus debt. I think debt in general, I agree that there's always tools and there's always situations it can be used, but I think there's two interesting facts. I think one, debt makes a lot less sense in a world with uncertain outcomes. And so as things turn over faster and faster, a lot of debt is based on, you know, I'm going to give you this because I have some certainty around what the cash flows back are going
to
be.
Yep.
But in a world where like attention moves so quickly, or like even energy gets so much radically cheaper, like trying to forecast, you know, years in the future, hell, soon even months, like why would you do that? And so I think that in general, that's another trend that's going to make debt. Death is still there, sadly. It is what it is. But debt less viable. The other thing, though, is I will say I'm not ready to make this claim entirely, but I actually do think there is sort of a bit of a moralistic bent on this as well. So as I was thinking a bit about the show today, I was revisiting Bitcoin is Venice, which again, shout out to Alan for writing that. It was just phenomenal book. Don't necessarily agree with everything in there, but there's so many good ideas. And it reminded me as I was paging through there of an idea. I actually had this in, I think, 2018, and I haven't thought of it since, which is, you know, there is a field of finance which outlaws that, which is Islamic finance.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not super deep in there. I think that would be a very interesting, you know, again, as we've talked about, if we had the economists of the world actually thinking about like the truly interesting questions instead of, you know, still debating modern monetary theory and stuff like this, it would be great. Well, one day we will. But, you know, it's interesting to me because from what I took away from reading his book very simply in Islamic finance and even in like certain, you know, Mediterranean age, you know, Renaissance finance, there in Islamic finance explicitly, though, you know, usury or debt-based lending is outlawed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they find ways around this to be able to compete in the modern world, because if you're not levered up like everyone else in the modern world, then good luck buying a house or a business or anything, you know, whatever it is, what it is. But it's interesting to me because, again, it kind of reflects, and I don't know if that's just, you know, debt, usury in a world where there's a hard asset and then, you know, monopoly money that you can kind of change the units of, so that's tricky, or if it's just debt lending in general. But I do think there is something core, fundamental, and sort of, frankly, moralistic in this idea of, hey, if we share an upside and downside together, then we're partners. And if things go sour for you, I'm not coming to like, whatever, repossess your house and your children and whatever you can, because, sorry, it sucks to suck. Whereas in that world, you know, obviously you're trading some certainty to that person, which, as you mentioned last week, and I thought a lot about this, a lot of people overvalue certainty anyway, because the certainty obviously, honestly, often isn't even there. But in exchange, you become effectively, you know, a sharecropper or a slave at the limit. And so, yeah, I'm not ready to make that claim entirely, but I do think there is something deeply moralistic about sharing both upside and downside versus mm-hmm. only one.
But the other thing, though, about sharing upside and downside is like, who is doing the work that yields the upside or downside? Is it the
AI
auteur? Is it the AI? Is it like, is it some corporate entity that some of those people are involved in, people and machines? And I think like one of the things that we haven't really digested yet is what is the role of a human in this world? I don't take the position that humans are irrelevant, but I also don't think humans are so special that there's stuff that we can do that the machines will never do. I think it's all just a question of like timing. And I think today, just like here in 2025, I think that humans still have insanely better taste and understanding of what other humans or what the world will need or want. And I don't think AIs have demonstrated any real clarity on how to get there. But I do think that could be the case someday. And so as a human, I think you want to spend a lot of time understanding how to get the best out of these tools so that you can be the one who's participating in the upside instead of fully outsourcing it to the tool. But you do need to learn how to outsource most of it to the tool, because if you don't, you're going to get left behind. Just like we saw at the hackathon, the people who were not outsourcing a lot of the heavy lifting to the machines couldn't keep up with the people who were, even if they were ultimately like less experienced or...
How do you think about when to do that? Because I thought about this in my own life, right? Like, I think maybe it was 2 months ago we discussed, I tried to vibe code something, it was a disaster.
But then, I know his answer is like...
Now?
Now.
But in 6 months, it'll be so much better.
But you build skills over time.
Yeah,
so one of the things, and Steve and I are in a chat with another friend, Matt, actually, he said it's okay to mention his name. Is that all right? Okay. He said it was okay.
You doxed him. Thanks a lot, DK.
Well, no, because we've been in this chat and the three of us have had different experiences with the VO3 prompting process. And I guess I don't want to fully out Steve, but Steve was like...
I'm the old laggard.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Steve was like laggard, like, why? He was calling me out on my tweet where I was like, wow, mind blown. And Steve's like, really? This is blowing your mind? This is garbage. You know?
Well, because I had sent you the video.
Was DK also on your lawn? Was that an issue?
Get off my lawn. But I think the point is, like, the natural thing is you get, like, a text input box, and you're like, okay, I guess now everybody can be a vibe director and make a video. So you like type whatever first thing to come to mind, then you do it, and then the machine pukes on it, and you're like, "Ah, this stuff sucks. Go do something else."
To be fair, I also had a similar experience. Yeah.
But that's, I mean, I've observed David and Matt and others, and there absolutely is skill development there, yeah. and we need to get on it, Max, yeah. for sure, so yeah. we don't get left behind, right?
Yeah.
And so I do, even if the tools improve every six or continuously, and so 6 months are way better, we need to be building our skills right now.
Yeah, I would encourage you to, like, anything that catches your eye, try to make it, whether you have an idea for a cool video you want to make or a cool piece of software or a Nostrobot.
It's like, I still want the music model, man. What I want, I'll tell you exactly what I want. I want the ability to go into a model and be like, here are like 20 like of my favorite Dilla beats, make me 20 more, and I want to rap on top of this, and now I want you to take care of all the mixing and all the mastering. Let's go.
Have you tried doing that yet?
No.
So pick that. That's something you want.
Do you think the models are there?
I think it's possible that I don't know what to expect from that. It would not shock me if you could make real progress toward that.
Really?
Agreed. And maybe like a simplified version of what you said, but yeah. like actually a simplified version would actually work.
But here's like where
it's worth trying.
Yeah.
Because again,
I try every 6 months.
Actually, to your point, Max, in 6 months, maybe today you can't build it, but 6 months you can. But if you build the skills now, you'll see where it breaks and where it's locked.
This
and then in
key.
6 months, then you're ready to go. Then in 6 months, it'll be 15 minutes and you've built it.
Yeah.
And also, like 6 months from now, you're going to be able to do so much more. So the thing you want to do today that you can't quite do will be super easy, but then your ambition will grow to be able to do more with it. So you always want to be able to play at the frontier of what's possible instead of wait, and like, what if you wanted to make a website and code it up in HTML? It's like, well, that's so easy. Like, you could do it in an afternoon. It doesn't matter, right? Mm. At one point, I was thinking back to the 90s, people used to get paid $100,000 a year to be a web developer, which is basically like HTML development, no college degree. Today, nobody'd pay for that, right? It's kind of just like easy, right? So I think the point is like, get good at the tools and the workflows, because it's going to be continually expanding, and the skills you develop today are things that you'll be able to use in that future too. And I think, like, you want this thing, go to Replit, try to build something, see where it breaks. You may have to coach it. Like, you may have to be the auteur and bring in your taste and be like, hey, I saw this beat. This is a particular YouTube link of a thing that I like.
Right.
Find stuff like it. Or you can say, hey, there's a service I know of called, I think, like, Suno and or Udio may, I don't know if they have APIs.
No, I've used, well, I don't know about APIs, but I've used.
But that's my point. You tell Replit, hey, like go check if Suno or Udio have APIs where we can have them do the generation work on the model and then pull it into the, 20 generations app that I want to use to like be my mix board or whatever.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay.
So
I'm convinced I need to play with this.
But just play with it, because if you, like, one of the things, actually, in talking on this group with Matt, one of the things I found that I was describing, because I've spent a lot of time vibe directing as well. And one of the things I found is that my process is not just drop something into a text, like have an idea, drop it into a text thing. It's like, first go to a pure LLM that's not designed to generate video, explain what you want to accomplish.
Meta prompt.
Yeah. Do the meta prompt. Do like a bunch of back and forth interview to get that thing right. And then when you feel like that's right, then tell it, hey, now I'm going to feed these into the service called VO3 that will produce 8-second clips. And so help me generate the prompts for each of the 8-second clips.
Got it. Yeah.
So it's really like, it's really not just a text box and then done.
Does Google have, I mean, I know they were playing with music models. Do you know if they have like a super state of the art music model?
They did recently. I think at I/O I saw something come out. They've got a few different like workspaces for doing these. I did see something in music, and I've even prompted something in music, but I haven't gone deep.
All right. Well, I'll play with that.
And it wouldn't surprise me if they have APIs for it too.
So we talked a lot about this, but this could potentially be an interesting transition point, because you said something there, which I think is very interesting. You said, okay, find the service you like and then tell it to go plug into their API.
Yep.
But what happens, DK, if a service that I ask to plug into the API says, sorry, you need to register with an email, and or we're going to rate limit your access to our API because we're still trapped in the old world of business? I don't know. Is there any kind of like alternative internet or web where there are no API keys and everything is easily accessible with a pub key you can spin up at once?
is this a Noster ad, thinly veiled? Extremely thinly veiled.
Extremely thinly veiled.
So one of the things actually that we'd talked about, and I think we actually have it on the list, if I remember. Do
yeah.
we have?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm allowed to talk about it.
Yeah. Talk away.
So one of the things also that happened in the chat is I've been trying to build a Noster bot that I think could be generally useful. I'm trying to build it for a specific use case, but I want the bot to be able to, you can tag it and say you upload a photo and then it can reply to your Noster message and it can say, you know, I can do that, like some sort of transformation process, you know, pay me 2,100 Bitcoin or whatever. And then when you zap it, it then replies with the output of the prompt. So it's basically like prompt, payment, result in like a sequence. To me, that feels like it should be a generalizable bot that a lot of people could build different, like, you know, integrations or like, what do I want to pay for? Like maybe the Udio music generation thing, or maybe dog to human, or maybe maybe image transformation or generation, maybe video generation. So that got me thinking about how collaboration on these things is so important, because Matt has built a bot that uses Lightning in a way that I wanted to use Lightning but was getting stuck on. Mm. And so the only way we could collaborate is that he had to add me to his team on Replit. I joined his team, reviewed all of his private prompts in his like team repository, and then I found the thing and I copied and pasted his prompt into my application. And then it worked. So, that there's like desire, just like organically discovered desire to collaborate and to be able to make use of other humans' prompts and the results and the outputs.
Or other AI's prompts too, not just humans. Yeah.
I think there's huge value there. In fact, if you think back to your entrepreneurial history, you've worked on curating different content, right? And so imagine everyone's prompts where they want to make it public. Curating all those and having them as Noster messages, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if
there needs to be a service for that, right?
Well, so I think there is, right?
I think Pablo is touching on these themes with this 10X, T-E-N-E-X. I was reading through his Noster profile and I think he's touching on these themes, but he's using it with like Rue, and I think it sounds like he can coordinate across Goose and some others, but I don't really understand exactly what it does or exactly if it fits into the workflows that Matt and I were doing, because I've sort of moved a lot more of my energy, at least this week, to Replit. And so could I, with Replit, use 10x and have my whole session somehow published out, or do I need to use 10x's LLM orchestration? Or I don't understand exactly how it fits in, but like my hope for, at least when I saw the high level of what it looks like 10x is trying to accomplish, it feels like it could be a way to get those prompts and the results and the resulting software kind of published out as Noster messages that other people could use. So Noster could become this like platform kind of a protocol for the kind of creation and sharing of prompts. And so it could become the best place to develop AI software. Like that's a big, like to me, the social media use case is cool, but like, wow. This thing is new. Nobody's tried to do this. It has flavors of what GitHub is good at, but it's not exactly GitHub. It's a different kind of thing, right?
Well, and that's why we were saying version control for live coding. Yeah. So I actually chatted with Pablo this week, and I think we should all do a
group chat
with him soon.
Catch up, yeah.
This guy, I mean, he moves at 20, I don't know, he moves at the speed of light. C equals Pablo. exactly. Well played, sir. My understanding, so is it, your understanding is it's some sort of like checkpoint system. So it's like, okay, the state of the software or whatever is this, and it's related to this was the prompt. And every time you change the prompt or issue a new prompt, you basically just like have like a series of checkpoints that are distributed across various Noster relays. Is that a fair representation? Or is that what you think makes sense?
I mean, I don't know exactly the structure that I would have in mind, and I don't know exactly what 10x does. So I'm starting from the problem or the experience that I had, which is I have a desire to collaborate with other people who are also prompting these things and to see the inputs and the outputs that they had. Those could be Noster messages for sure.
Right.
How exactly those trails are followed and how I navigate them and find the right ones, I don't have a good sense of that.
Yeah.
I have a question. I think I know the answer, but like, let's say you've done a series of prompts and you've produced a result, mm-hmm. intermediate results and then a final result. And I'm like, you know, I want to do that. I want to collaborate. And I did the same prompts. Is it deterministic?
No.
It's not, right? It's not perfectly deterministic, but I would guess in those cases, if it's a relatively constrained thing, I think you're likely to get a very similar output.
That just needs to be considered this too, in terms of either expectation setting or how it's designed.
And it's interesting because I think that's one of those things where it's like, it's a lot like physics, where it's like, it's deterministic enough to get things done that we want to get done today. But like, we have no fucking clue how quantum physics works. Similarly, like people don't understand how LLMs work. Anyway, it's like, oh, I understand. It's like, no, this stuff is still alchemy, which is cool, but it's also a bit of a black box, which is also scary.
Despite, you know, physics and the quantum nature of reality, you can still build a car and drive across the country.
It's
with
still
it.
Useful. Like we still fly in planes. DK and I have, that's a long story.
We had a little plane horrible. Moment coming out of Vegas.
I try and avoid the Boeing Maxes and, oh my God. Anyways.
Did you tell Steve about it?
No, I didn't.
we're sitting in on the plane right next to each other.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Then he realizes what plane
he's on. Well, they're about to close the door.
They switched the plane on me because I'm very like, I'm always diligent. I don't want to fly the Max. Hell no.
And they're about to close the door and he looks up and he sees the card and it says Boeing whatever Max.
Yeah.
And he was like, we got to go. We can't fly on this. Like, what are you talking about? He's like, we got to get off this plane. I got to get off. Let's rebook. We're doing it right now. It's like, dude. Let's just
and because I was I a talk DK, about a cliff. He kept me calm and we'll do it. But like that would not be my
and then the
choice.
Ahmedabad was it the one this week? Sadly, I think what was it 200
in India
something yeah.
And sadly, I mean that's tragic. And to link that back a little bit to the Bitcoin discussion, my hope, the sort of original discussion, is on a Bitcoin standard. Like, you don't have a company like Boeing that gets totally hollowed out and is just doing things for super. And again, I think this is an important point to really hammer home, and it relates to what Mark said last week, which is, in a world where you're measuring capital stock over time versus GDP, which is a flow, which is a totally worthless metric and a totally gameable metric, you start having much more long-termism. And I think, you know, the issues that many people have with Boeing, and I think rightfully so, is that, you know, the last several years has been clearly focused on a flow instead of a stock. And I hope on a Bitcoin standard, companies and individuals and everyone are more focused on stocks instead of flows.
But I don't think you're going to get Boeing to shape up. I think you're going to get somebody to start some sort of new entity, nonprofit organization that creates, you know, Vibe creates an airplane schematic that's open source, and Vibe manufactures airplanes so that everything's transparent. You can see what process went into it.
I love it.
What, you know, like, I think that's actually the future. It sounds so crazy, science fiction-y, bizarre, like you'll never get there. But we're actually like on the path to getting there.
Totally. You know? And I think, well, you made me think of several things with that. But one thing that I would answer also on the sort of Bitcoin and the fairness thing is that, okay, fixed supply. I think a lot of us have gone down that rabbit hole, generally fans. But like, I don't even think that's necessarily the feature of Bitcoin that I like the most. In fact, I know Peter Todd and others have argued that a small tail emission actually could be good. That's like Monero, one of their interesting trades. They have a fixed tail emission, which becomes infinitesimally small over time. There's an argument over whether that's better or not. I tend to be on the fixed supply camp. But the thing that to me is so beautiful about Bitcoin and Nostr is increasingly, you know, whenever people tell me, it's not that right-wing thing. It's like, actually, no, it's not. I go back to my conversation with Ben Ark, formerly known as BTC Socialist. And the point is that it's something new. It is a commons. In fact, it is, to my mind, a mix of stateless socialism, which is very important to say, is stateless socialism, a commons, commonly owned and governed by the whole world, and free markets on top of that. But the free markets, as Ben explained, can never get too big, or rather the companies can never get too big and try and eat the whole commons, because if they do, they get what he termed, a very eloquent term, the Adam Smith bitch slap. And that's because, again, that of if they get too big and like a cancer cell try and eat the whole organism, then what they're doing is they're focusing again on the stock, the flow instead of the stock, because then the stock is gone and you can't have these, you know, you can't have new businesses in the future. So it's a very delicate balance. And that's where I hope we're going, is commons with free markets that operate within the DAO. DAO TAO.
So something we've not talked about, but is a very common criticism or concern about deflationary currency, like Bitcoin or, you know, fixed supply currency, is that it won't work for a growing economy. People will not spend their money. They'll just hoard. They won't buy things. I mean, my take on, first of all, that extreme of view, I think, doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. Like, people are going to still buy things because they desire things. Even we already see that dynamic today. Like,
and it's a trade of
like if I buy an iPhone now, I know next year's iPhone is going to be better.
Then why do you buy the iPhone?
So do I wait a year?
Wait until they die and then buy.
You know, wait 5 years, 10 years to wait till I die? No, I want the value now. Yeah. So I pay the money now.
Yeah.
Even if I knew it's better, or basically I'm getting more for the money, I buy it now. So humans already do that. I think it could reduce some frivolous spending, and it could shift the savings rate versus credit rate, but not like completely to,
of course,
to the other end of the spectrum. And a shift of that, I think, probably is healthy for
extremely healthy.
Americans in particular, who have a very low savings rate.
We consume a lot. And to your point, I think that is the answer. Anyone that's ever told me, but deflation's bad, I literally just say, do you have a phone? Do you have a computer? Why'd you buy those things? You know it's going to be better. You know it's going to be cheaper. It's like, well, I need them. Cool. It's like, on the margin, yes. Do we buy less Chinese knickknacks or whatever, like, or whatever it is? Of course. And that's probably awesome for the world, you know? So I think the deflation argument, like, is just like clearly proven wrong by technology. And it's frankly a really dumb argument. But what I was saying even before that, I realized I didn't complete my thought correctly, is the deflationary aspect is great, the fixed supply is great, but what I really care about, to your point with the Boeing and all this other stuff, is transparency.
Yes, transparency.
It's transparency. The key of these systems is it's transparent. There is no black box. Anyone can audit and see what's happening on all of these systems.
And I'm actually agnostic to, like, is it deflationary? Is there tail emission? Like, if it had been created with tail emission, but it was transparent, I'd be okay with that. I think it's bad to change it.
Yeah.
I think it has to be what it was.
That's what I was gonna say. In addition to transparency, it's also belief, the credibility that it's not going to change.
Yeah. That's true.
So whether it's 0% or 5% or tail emission or whatever, like, transparency and belief is not going to change.
And those are really features of leaderlessness. Yeah. Like, when you have a leader, you have somebody penning blog posts or deciding what the community is going to do next. That's where the problems come from. If you want transparency and resistance to changes, you kind of need it to be, you know, what do they call it, a Mexican standoff? You need it to be like, everybody is fighting for it to just not change, right?
Yeah. I think there was a wise guy who said somewhere, I can't quite recall, that the root problem in all of this is the trust required to make it work. That's the issue, right? There's like, anytime you have to trust in humans will get corrupted, full stop. And if not that human, then they're, you know, whatever kid or whoever takes over. So
I think you can also make an argument that the fixed supply is the right decision, but to me that is a second order argument. The two most important things are what you guys said, transparency and resistance to change. But you can make the argument that if there are a tail emission or any kind of like inflation, that there'd always be a drive toward zero, meaning there'd be like a lot of people wanting to reduce, or because there'd be like a new altcoin that you know, one-ups it, and there'd always be this like natural pressure towards 0%. And so just by starting at 0%, you alleviate any kind of pressure to do that.
Yeah. The other thing with fixed supply is just like, as the value of wealth in the world grows, the number goes up. So you still get to be early. Yeah. So anybody, you know, maybe the unfortunate people who, you know, are born 100 years from now don't get to participate in that. But anybody who's born today still gets to benefit from
And even those people, I mean, like, eventually, like, wealth will rework its way through size. And look, I'm also not one of these people that's like totally anti-state either. Like, I think, you know, the state, when it operates transparently and within the realm of the commons without taking the commons over
control. When does that ever happen?
Well, I mean, but maybe this gives the, you know, the petri dish that we need to see that. Like, I'm not saying there should be zero taxation of anything ever as well. Like, there's probably, there's a lot of experiments to run over the next decades.
I just thought of something that we need to talk about today.
Okay.
So we're not going to talk about treasury companies. I'm sorry.
Okay. It's going to rug us.
Fair enough.
But it's something we all care about. We briefly mentioned it. We had the idea on the last show.
Yeah.
We had an idea generated, and that's a new monthly meetup.
Right. Oh, this is big. Yeah.
At Presidio Bitcoin.
Yep.
But also we want to see it over time expand globally. So
it's already expanding globally.
It is already expanding globally. I don't know if you know that.
I don't know that.
So, okay.
Actually, I did see that. Yeah.
And we've gone. So, I mean, the concept is, there's already BitDevs, which has been a meetup for over a decade within the Bitcoin community. It's a technical focused monthly meetup that started in New York, and it's in many dozens of cities around the world now. You know, usually attracts anywhere from like 10 to 50 people, depending on the city. And they just go through a series of, they talk about there's a series of topics that they talk about. Anyone in the audience can either ask a question or answer a question. It's not like a presentation. It's a Socratic seminar style. So there's moderators to help steer and guide, but they don't dominate the conversation. It's a really great format. People love it. It's also extremely technical. And so technical, even like if you're an engineer and technical, if you're not into Bitcoin technical stuff,
it's in the weeds.
It's in the weeds. So our idea on the last show was like, we need a meeting like that, but for product design builders. And I mean, I think all of us immediately liked the idea. We've shared it with a bunch of other people. Everyone loves the idea. So like, I think it's a good idea. It's one of those ideas like, why didn't we think of this years ago? So
PBJ, baby.
So we already have, so it's going to be the fourth Thursday of every month at Presidio Bitcoin. I guess we're announcing it now.
We haven't heard it here first.
Well, because we're going through name changes too. So like,
Do we have the name?
So we were pretty excited about the name B product, B with the Bitcoin symbol B. So it really emphasized Bitcoin and spending Bitcoin and using Bitcoin every day. And then Stephen Geller had the idea of Builder.
That's a good name.
With a Bitcoin B symbol, just Builder. And a lot of us like that even better. So I had already acquired all the social media accounts and GitHub and everything for B product, but now I think I'm going to do that for Builder.
Builder's good.
And we're going to go with that. But if you're listening...
Does it have the B in the domain name?
Not the domain name.
Not the domain name. Okay.
But he...
I learned on X, you cannot have a Bitcoin B symbol as the handle. You can have it in the name.
Okay. Like the display name.
The display name. Yep.
Yeah. But perhaps as Elon becomes more of a Bitcoiner, that will change.
And then same with GitHub too. You can have it in the display name, but not the handle for GitHub. But you know, whatever.
Whatever. Yeah.
You're not gonna upgrade to Moneyball.
So we're gonna. Oh yeah, I should change the B in Moneyball.
Yeah, you should.
That's if you can. Idea. Yeah.
Wherever I can.
All the alpha.
So. Yeah, I'm super excited about this.
It's a great idea.
All three of us volunteered to moderate it. I think Haley volunteered to moderate as well. So we got plenty of people enthusiastic to moderate. Actually, and then someone else who I don't know yet, but he pinged me with a bunch of great ideas, and I'm gonna try to meet with him and maybe infuse some of his ideas into it, and he might help organize it as well. But anyone listening who lives in the Bay Area or is going to be in the Bay Area, if you're around the fourth Thursday of every month, please swing on by.
Do you have to apply or be on a list? Or
we'll have like a meetup.com.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a public invite. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think maybe put the special call out there. I mean, the idea is, you know, to Steve's point, BitDevs is so technical, but now there's a lot of PMs, investors, people that are exploring different kinds of products or business models and just want to riff on, okay, we have these tools now with Bitcoin as the monetary network. What can we build with it? And I personally, one thing that I would love to see, and part of our discussion around this last week was, it was so cool at BitDevs having folks from companies like Apple and Uber or whatever. I mean, given that we are in the Bay Area, my guess is all these major tech companies have at least some hardcore Bitcoiners within them. Like if that's you, you should definitely come out, because maybe there's opportunities, you know, meeting with other people in the space that can help you figure out how to get Bitcoin into the products you're working on at your company.
Yeah, I think this meetup will be way more accessible for just more people, but Silicon Valley. I mean, part of the mission of Presidio Bitcoin and even in the show is bridging the gap between Bitcoin and Silicon Valley. I think, you know, inviting people in Silicon Valley to BitDevs is a bit of a stretch for most people, but this meetup should be amazing for Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley is all about innovation, thinking of the next great application. We finally have the tools and we've proven it out to be able to integrate Bitcoin into the applications quickly. I think it'll be awesome. We have a ton of ideas for what will actually be done in this meetup. I think we're going to just probably experiment with all of them and see what feels right. But we'll certainly, the topic list, just like BitDevs, will be public. It'll be on GitHub. So anyone can submit topic ideas. It'll then be curated by the moderators and figure out the, you know, we're obviously limited on time, so you have to prioritize the list of topics. And then we'll go through those topics. What are those topics? We can certainly cover any like new products that are announced in the space. Or any like new design tools or vibe coding tools or ways to build. We can cover that. I think there's probably room for like doing demos as well, live demos.
I love that.
And maybe a call to the audience. Anyone who wants to do a live demo, you get 1 minute or whatever, something like that. That would probably be great. Yeah. And many other ideas. So it should be great. So hope to see a lot of people come out for that.
Yeah.
Cool.
Love it. Super excited.
Speaking of products in Bitcoin, I know we had touched on, but I don't think we may not have time for this, but Horizon and Sovana, is it? I think we were going to try to discuss real time the trade-offs and advantages of each.
5 minutes?
Do we have? Yeah, is that? Yeah, let me at least get it started.
I don't know more than 5 minutes worth.
Okay,
perfect.
Let's see. So, we've known about Horizon since the beginning of the year or December or so, because they work on Presidio Bitcoin. And David and I helped them a little bit. And then Sovana is started by one of my best friends, and he announced it in Vegas during the conference. So I think the space is super interesting. I mean, yeah, so for people who don't know what these startups are, if you own a home, and a lot of people own a home and a lot of their wealth is tied up in that home equity, and they might not own any Bitcoin, or they might feel underexposed to Bitcoin, but they don't have the cash flow or liquidity to acquire the amount of Bitcoin exposure they'd like. So both of these startups allow you to take some of your home equity out and buy Bitcoin with it. So it's pretty compelling. Obviously, if you know, it depends on which thresholds you choose, how aggressive you are. But if you do a modest, you pull out 10% of your home equity and put it into Bitcoin, and that's your total exposure to Bitcoin, seems like reasonable for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And then the two models do differ, I think. I'm certainly not an expert on it, but I think with Sovana, there's no loan involved. So you don't pay interest. Mm. And the model is relative, and you actually form literally an LLC partnership between them and you as the homeowner. Mm. And then if the price of Bitcoin goes up, you split the upside 50-50. If the price doesn't move at all, you literally you gain nothing, you owe nothing. And I know that Sanjay pointed out that just because to point out that there's no interest accruing over time.
Right.
If the value of Bitcoin goes down over, you know, whatever period of time this is, I forget if you can choose the period of time or if there's a minimum, but whether it's 4 years or 10 years or whatever, if the value of the price of Bitcoin goes down, then you as a homeowner you'd be out that money. So,
and they're fronting the capital to buy it, right? Like you take, I don't know, simple math. If it's like, say, $1 million home and you do 10%, you've got $100K. And so they front the capital to buy like one Bitcoin for you.
And then they get a lien against the home as collateral.
So if the price goes down, then would you actually be stuck having to pay the loan back, or would they wait until
there's no loans?
Well, so how do they get their 100K back in the world where?
I can only guess, but like they, I think the homeowner would have to pay Savannah, like the contractor, they have to find a way to pay them. And if they don't, then they've got a lien on the home.
So they'd have to pay 100K in the example, even if the price of Bitcoin were 50K.
Yeah. I wonder how, like how much.
Well, to be clear. So I think like, yeah, let's say it's $1 million home. You get 10%. Let's say it's $1 million home. Let's say you have $500,000 of equity. And then you take 10% of that and put it into Bitcoin. So $50,000 of Bitcoin. Fast forward 10 years. Let's say that $50,000 is now only worth $40,000 because Bitcoin price has gone down. The homeowner would owe $10,000 to Savannah is what my understanding is. And if they have to come up with the money.
You're saying the price of Bitcoin went from $50,000 to $40,000?
Yeah.
Or the price of Bitcoin went from $100,000?
No, they in this example, they bought $50,000 of Bitcoin.
So they sold the asset. So it's collateralized.
And the value of that is worth $40,000 in 10 years.
And potentially, I don't know how this would work, but they could also say, so it's double collateralized because you have collateral with the Bitcoin and with the house, I'm guessing. And so—
Yeah, that's probably how the lien is structured.
So depending on how that's structured, it could be like, you don't have to pay us back until you sell the house or something like that. I don't know. But in general, I like this idea in our earlier conversation, no usury, shared upside.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Whereas I think the Horizon model there, it is structured as a loan. So there's interest, but honestly, I'm not, you know, expert at either.
People shouldn't
take what we're saying as gospel, but I think it's super interesting space. I hope both of them, you know, do well. I think it could be a real service to people and giving access to Bitcoin to people who desire it and probably would be better off with that access. And it's good to have, I think it's generally good to have two competing models. I think both are probably sensible models. So it's good to have two competing models and we'll see how
each
does.
Do you think they typically would target or serve a different type of homeowner?
I'm just not deep enough on the comparison to...
Because my understanding would be like Horizon, you capture like the full upside, but you're subject to some accrued interest. Whereas Savannah, there's no accrued interest, you capture less of the upside because you share it with them. So it's like, are you willing to trade off?
So it's a little bit of a risk-reward
Maybe Horizon's
difference.
Riskier, but higher reward. Savannah caps some of the risk. Yeah. It depends on other liquidity profile and stuff.
Depends on how orange-pilled you are as well.
Yeah, how much you've studied.
I think that is true. So
I
could imagine both being success, you know, both getting customers.
Yeah. And I don't think they're locked in stone, right? Like in a month, they may change exactly what the offering is. I think the more interesting point there to me is it's a big market. like how much money is there tapped up in home equity in the United States? Like order of magnitude.
I'm guessing dozens, if not hundreds of
residential.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know the answer, but I mean like global all real estate.
300 trillion.
Like 300 trillion.
But a lot of that's
commercial. So U.S. is 70 to 100 trillion maybe or something, and then residential half that or
a
third.
That's what I was guessing.
Dozens
of trillions was
dozens of trillions.
So and a lot of that is growth. These are people who bought a house, you know, for $10,000 in 1960 or whatever, and now it's, you know, worth $2 million or something.
I believe six raspberries is what the rumors paid on Twitter. I also love that meme where it's
the
like
dancing, line dancing.
I was just gonna say the boomers bought, they're selling us expensive houses and the kids are selling them expensive Bitcoin. So it's a fair trade.
Well, how many homeowners would you guess are in America? 80 million or is that 60 million?
That sounds high, but
there's 300 million people. So let's say.
So
50
million homeowners. Maybe, and then what do you think the average price of a home is? 500,000?
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe something like that.
So a million times 50 million people, that's 50 trillion. So $25 trillion.
Yeah.
So it sort of
big market
lines up with.
Yeah.
Back of the envelope. Yeah. So anyways, very interesting market. And there's a lot more to discuss there. We should find out more in the future. But since we don't want to totally rug our listeners, I'm not going to talk too much about the...
you got to keep it to 1 minute.
The treasury companies. But what I will do is I'll loop back to a point I wanted to make with you, DK, which is someone showed that Boeing was offering, I think, their bonds. I think I got this from the punter Jeff dude who's deep in MicroStrategy.
Yeah.
about 4.5%.
These are on preferred.
I don't know any of the deal structures. Okay. All I know is if Boeing has a bond worth 4.5%, seems pretty damn risky to me. MicroStrategy's bonds offerings are 10%, 6x over collateralized by Bitcoin, roughly. So to your question of what's going to happen with companies like Boeing, my increasing prediction is the well-managed Bitcoin treasury companies, of which today I'm only convinced there's one, MicroStrategy. Maybe there'll be more.
You got the only one that's well-managed?
The only one where I have done enough of my own homework and my initial vibe check tells me Saylor is extremely, he knows what he's doing as responsible. I can't say that about any others. Not to say they're wrong. I think in general, the more things get frothy and meme-y and the more you see podcasters launching this, the more
when are we an exact treasury company?
And with that, the PBJ is going public, baby. Smack it. And our sponsor is Chamath. It's going to be fantastic. What could possibly go wrong? And then there's going to be a PBJ coin too. It's going to be fucking fantastic.
Do want to rug the audit, like you said.
Fair distribution.
Fair distribution. Just come scan your retina. We got you. Nothing will ever go wrong. Yeah. We promise. Raised 100 mil from Andreessen. It's going to be great. But my broader point there is, I think what's actually going to happen is they're not going to be the only one, of course. It's the only one that I now feel comfortable saying. It seems like he's doing good risk management. But I think what's going to happen is those companies that are well capitalized by Bitcoin are going to buy those that are not. And so, some companies, we've talked about, don't necessarily have to go full issue debt to buy Bitcoin. They'll just dip their own treasury in or whatever. But eventually, I think companies like Boeing basically will just get purchased by companies that are capitalized by Bitcoin. So given that Micro Saylor is himself an aeronautical engineer and is probably just horribly offended by what's happening, spicy out there prediction, maybe one day they'll be owned by Strategy.
2025 prediction?
2026.
Okay.
I'm conservative.
Did you happen to catch the Jordan Peterson, Michael Saylor?
I did. Bit? It was fantastic.
Did you get the Daily Wire after? They basically rug you at the end of the... It was a good episode. Was that hour and a half or something?
Yeah.
You get to the end of it and there's all these great topics that are not more philosophical, broad reaching, not the typical kind of talking points. And then we're going to continue that over on some other service that's behind a paywall and stuff. So,
which by the way, one cool thing, because we saw at the PBJ hackathon, really cool project, which was you pay to unlock ad-free versions of a podcast. And I introduced that guy. He wanted to chat with Oscar from Fountain. And I noticed, I don't know if you guys use Fountain, but Fountain has already unveiled versions of that. So I think it was one of Marty's podcasts or something that I saw. He's the early tester. But you can go ahead and buy ad-free versions. And I was like, damn, that's the kind of innovation we need. And that was, by the way, the Saylor interview was fantastic. It was the more I hear about this guy, the more I'm like, man, he's sitting here talking about angels and demons and dropping spells and stuff. I don't know if the Wall Street investor base is going to be excited about that, but he's an interesting character and very smart.
And did you go from slightly negative to more positive?
Yes, I did.
What was the transition for you?
How much time? We don't have a ton of time on this, but just doing more homework and just realizing, I think Saylor, I'm not saying I agree with everything from a values perspective, right? Do I think it's great that this stuff is going to get financialized before it becomes money? Probably not. In my dream world, I would like it to become money first. That's what we're all focused on. Yeah. I'm very much in sort of the Jack camp on that. However, I'm also a realist and a Taoist. And the way I see it is it's inevitable. This is what's going to happen. And, as we said on that very first show, when I gave a hat tip to Pierre for excellence, I'll give a hat tip right now to Michael Saylor. The more I came in skeptical, the more I have studied and seen, the amount of, complete over-collateralization, the amount of risk and leverage seems extremely low to me. Not financial advice, doing your research, blah, 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 blah. But the more I've studied it, and the more I see the way he's innovating and using AI to innovate these new products to go out there and completely reprice the $300 trillion bond market and potentially capture, he says 1%, maybe a lot more of that, maybe even take the treasury.
You say $300 billion bond?
$300 trillion bond market.
Right.
Those in real estate, those are the two biggest markets on earth, right? And so he's lethally attacking one of them at such speed and with such conviction. The more I study and the more that I see that is hey man, you're getting paid on this STRD, which we talked about last week, their new junk bond offering, which is offering 10% perpetual. And it's still, like, even though it's lower in this stack, I mean, still, you would have to believe Bitcoin goes below, my understanding. I'm taking the second hand, but I think 15K for at least several months, maybe several years to start being in trouble. And that just seems like very close to impossible at this point. And I never say impossible because it's Bitcoin. The more I study this, the more I'm just like, holy fucking hell, this guy is playing on another level. He's like executing Pierre's speculative attack on steroids. No one else is still doing it. Now you got some copycats, but like, again, I'm skeptical of the
Pierre's
copycats.
Doing it, isn't he?
Well, yes. and I'm very interested in that.
Yeah.
But like, I just, you know, I like to tip my hat where I see excellence. And yeah. The more I study him, the more I'm like, this guy is, he's executing at a level that I've never seen before. And it's just, it's impressive. So.